I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Go Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a trip to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute pamper session, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. I'll speak to people who remind us to take better care of ourselves and people who will motivate us and inspire positive change. This podcast is made possible by Sally Hansen, the creator of which was an inspirational woman who promoted the message of self-care all the way back in the 1930s. Whether it's a quick tan application or a cuticle oil top-up, Sally Hansen wants us to have the power to feel like our best selves. This week on The Good Glow, I talk to my friend Owen McDermott. He talks to me about his brand new show, The Deirin and Owen Breakfast Show on 2FM, how they have big boots to fill, how he deals with both positive and negative comments, and what he thinks it will be like to work with a super talented Deirin. Owen is incredibly honest about his struggles, in particular self-harming, and how an unprovoked attack in 2016 has affected him. He's funny, caring, and humble, and someone who I'm proud to call my friend. He also has a brilliant podcast called Deep Diving with Owen McDermott, which I love. I hope you enjoy. Owen, welcome to the Good Glow podcast.
Thanks for having me. You're a podcast gargantuan now. You're a podcast superstar.
Well, that means a lot coming from you. So obviously on the Good Glow, I haven't had any guys. So I thought long and hard of who I wanted to kind of represent men, I suppose, on my podcast, and you came to mind. So thank you so much for agreeing to be on The Good Glow.
I should either be nervous or flattered. Wonderful
or
mix of the two, yeah.
First of all, congratulations on the new show with my dear friend, Deirin Garrahy. I'm so excited to hear it. How are you feeling about it?
I'm feeling good about it, I think. I've done radio for a long time. And I don't know whether there's truth in it, but certainly the perception is that the breakfast show of any radio station is the big show. And the industry speak is, if you win breakfast, you win the day. In terms of if your breakfast show is healthy and it's doing well, the rest of the station kind of follows suit, like it sets the tone for the station. So in terms of legacy, it's had really big names on it. And also in terms of... It was an interesting one with 2FM because they decided to change up a lot of the schedule when a lot of the schedule was healthy. They just said, we're going to freshen it up, but it wasn't. They decided to do it because it was like a dying beast. So I guess it's like when Grimmie took over from Chris Moyles or Annie, not comparing ourselves to that level, but I'm just saying in terms of like people loved Breakfast Republic and it was doing well. So it's that thing of you're really excited and also you're kind of conscious that you're inheriting a vehicle that has like these really loyal fans and people are like resistant to change by very nature. So it's you're kind of on this mission to win people over rather than arrive like I'm here to save morning radio. You're kind of coming in kind of humble, actually.
Well, that's amazing. And all, I suppose, everyone across the schedule in 2FM has been so amazing. And I saw Lottie's Instagram post where she said that she can't wait to work across all the shows again. So it seems like there's a really good vibe.
Yeah, like everybody has worked really hard. And there's a funny thing because people may or may not know me and you started off in Spin together years ago. So like a decade ago, maybe?
Yeah, more.
More. And... There's an extra... So 2FM was my first not commercial radio station job in that you're held to a higher level of scrutiny and you have to do things a certain way. And I've fallen on the wrong side of that a few times, not in very pretty ways. But like even people like Lottie, who is the... You know, people who are just goodness. Like Lottie shines from... the inside out. She's just a beautiful person. I'm just saying her because you mentioned her and any other number of really lovely, dedicated, hardworking and like benign, I mean that in the best possible way, like harmless people. The shit you take just because of where you work, it's a really peculiar phenomenon and you can't kick back. Like when I was working on XFM, I went over to this London radio station and I got initially a little bit of stick just for being Irish and I was taking over a show that, you know, from a beloved English presenter. And you can kind of clap back a little bit stronger. You can't do that in RTE. And nor should you. It's not the right look, and there's a level of decorum. So I can't remember what the question was, but that's the answer to whatever you asked me.
The good vibes in 2FM.
Oh, and, yeah, everyone's lovely.
And Dearon coming in now, obviously, yourself and Dearon go far back too. I remember when I was interviewing Dearon for a job in Spin, you text me because she was actually reading the traffic on your show. It's just such a small industry. And you said, she's one of the good ones. She's great.
She was obviously talented very quickly. She used to read the traffic on our drive show. And we just started having a little bit of chat with her. And you kind of go, oh, there's obviously a spark there. And this is before she had done anything. And then we set her a challenge one day to rap the traffic or to sing the traffic. And she did a rendition of Justin Bieber's Love Yourself. And it was just very well done. And people went mad for it. And she set up her page and off she went doing her comedy thing. And it's just, she is a phenomenon in the genuine sense of the word. Like, what she has recruited and the audience she's built in like 18 months, 2 years, people won't get that in their entire careers, you know. So she's, yeah, it's exciting.
Well, I know you both so well that I can see how perfectly it's going to work. But are you getting that vibe?
I hope so. I've never co-hosted with anybody. And she did stuff with Marty on Spin, and she did a little bit on Today FM. But in terms of, I guess, I suppose we're both front men, if you like.
Uh-huh.
And front ladies. We're both front people. So it's that whole thing of, I guess you have to be authentic, but it's also, there's a bit of a persona, like, you listen to me on the radio, yeah, good morning! Hey! It's not, you know, I'm not that loud all the time, and neither is she. And so it's that thing of, I suppose, we'll have to find that natural rhythm and hope it's not like competing egos, which I don't think it will be, but it's that thing of, you know, we're in each other's spaces now.
Do you feel like, I suppose, all your hard work that you've put into radio over the last 10 years, and I know I've worked with you, you don't just finish your show and pick up your bag and walk out the door, like, you put your heart and soul into every day, into every show. Do you feel like this is kind of the big gig, or you've probably had that moment a few times?
It's not that I feel it's the big gig. Well, it is a big gig, and it's like I alluded to, it's a big gig that has a dedicated audience for the show that's just vacated. I kind of feel like it's a bit of not a reinvention, maybe like a return to where I came from, because when I started this show, maybe some people heard it and maybe they didn't, it was kind of a Chris Moyles-esque inspired show, in that it was a zoo, all the production team were on air, everybody kind of had roles. We had this producer, Reg, you had this kind of maniac laugh that people absolutely loved, and she was, you know, wild energy and unbridled in the best possible way. And all our production team was on air. And it was gimmicks, and it was prank calls, and it was messing, and it was laughs, and it was, you know, it was very successful very quickly, and it was definitely a Marmite show. People who hated it, but the people who loved it, and that is when you're on that kind of trajectory, that's special. Like, I'd rather that happened and people wrote you off quickly, but the audience that stayed with you were like fanatical about you. I'd rather that than be successful. And here's an introduction to a song. That was that song. Text in now. Like, that's its own type of radio, and there's a skill to it, but it's not my kind of radio. So when we started that with 2FM, that's where we were. And then the identity of the show changed. That team kind of fell away for various different reasons. And we went through like 4 producers in the space of about a year. And I kind of ran out of energy. To be honest, I kind of not lost the love, but yeah, I ran out of energy trying to, it's basically like creating soap opera. You got to build up the characters of the people who come in and get people invested in them. And then you build them up and then they're gone, and new people in, you build them up and they're gone, and new people. And I got kind of tired. And then also, I've like, outside of that kind of radio, I'd have a natural interest in like pop culture and current affairs and stuff. So the show became that a bit more, like a Matt Cooper light, not all the time, don't get me wrong now, but, I don't know. It was, that even polarized people even further, I think. So same again, the people who were into it were really into it, and then the people who hated it hated it. So all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, maybe in the space of a year or 18 months, I think the persona that I had built, it took like a sharp left. And then some people kind of go, oh great, so Breakfast Republic is the comedy, Nikki and Jenny is the lifestyle kind of stuff, Tracy is the music, and Owen is the more, yeah, like Matt Cooper light. So I felt everything had a home on 2FM. And in terms of like public service box tick, I think we nailed it. But yeah, also some people didn't like it. And so I kind of feel going back to Breakfast, your only aim on Breakfast is kind of to get a smile and a laugh and make someone's shit traffic jam a little bit better.
Yeah, like the brief is so clear. Just yeah. Put people in a good mood.
I remember when I did work at that, the radio station in London, XFM, big stars would come in. That was the main difference, because radio in Ireland is brilliant. Like, they're really talented people here. But the big difference working over in the UK is the access to people. Like, if you have someone who's like a star, but not a megastar, like, you know, no disrespect, like Ollie Murs, for example, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, he will always sell some tickets, but he's not, you know, he's not Justin Bieber, right? So if Ollie Murs comes to Ireland, everybody wants to talk to Ollie Murs, even though it's only Ollie Murs. You got to fight to get 6 minutes with Ollie Murs. Whereas in XFM, I remember clear as day one day, I was doing their drive time show, and my boss came in and he said, Chris and Johnny from Coldplay are in today.
Oh, gosh.
And they're going to do your show, just the way the timing's fallen. And you had half an hour with Chris Martin and Johnny. And you found out on the day, like, if that was over here, that'd be a year in the planning, and then it could fall through on the last day. But I remember I did my one and only interview with the lads, and Chris Martin said, you know, I was a little bit starstruck, to be honest, and I was doing that whole thing. So tell me about the inspiration for this album. And it was Milo Zalato that has Paradise, mm-hmm. and Every Teardrop is a Waterfall. And that Chris Martin's answer, and I just thought it was kind of the most humble, brilliant answer. He just said, man, I mean, I hate when musicians go off on their big mission. Realistically, I hope someone has a better traffic jam because of a song we made. And he's right,
like,
as well,
yes,
you know.
That is.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? So I feel like Breakfast is hopefully the musical equivalent of that. We could do a big, we want to be this, we want to do that. Hopefully people have a laugh.
I think, through being your friend for over 10 years, I think you're very hard on yourself. I think you are a bit of a perfectionist. And I think it's been very busy for you in front of the cameras, but your life has been very busy behind the cameras too. And I really respect how honest you've been about a lot of things.
Thank you.
I suppose you have to make a decision if you're going to share your story or not.
Yeah.
Did you sit down one day and think about it, or did it just happen?
Specifically, why are you saying here? Which one, Georgie? There's
okay,
a few
let's
stories.
Start with let's start with the self harm.
Yeah, I did specifically sit down about that one. That came about. I got the gig on The Voice, and as soon as, I guess, there are so many charities out there all vying for attention. And so what they'll do is they'll reach out to whoever happened, not exclusively, and it's not cynical, it's necessary, but they'll reach out to whoever's on the big gig at the time and, hey, will you come to our photo call, or will you tweet this or whatever? And they invited me to launch One of the Darknesses into Light. This is like 8 years ago or whatever. And so, sure, yeah, it went along. And Mam worked in a designated disadvantaged school she's retired now, but in Ballantyre in Dublin. And she knew Pieta House because there was a lot of really troubled kids in her school. And so she would have dealt with, you know, like the community services and the guards and stuff a lot. And she just spoke very highly of them and said, oh, you should do that one. And then I went to the launch and I kind of heard about what they did. And at that stage, I had gone through a period of self-harming, but I had reconciled it. It was in the past, so I could kind of step back and look at it a bit philosophically. And I said, yeah, do you know what? I will talk about that, and I'll do it kind of through them. So,
did you feel like it was a safe environment?
I just did a video on YouTube, and I just did it in one take, and like the basic synopsis of it was I was working on Spin, and I was doing a weekend show, and it was doing very well. And then it was one of those serendipitous happenings, you know, Andy Ashton. So the this guy from the UK who was a big radio boss on this station, I ended up working for XFM, which over in the UK is a legendary station. Like, the alumni are pretty incredible. Like, that's very famously where Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant met Carl Pilkington. Like, Carl Pilkington was like the T-boy in XFM. They're like, he's funny, let's bring him on our show. And Russell Brand started there, and Dermot O'Leary and Jimmy Carr and all these cool people. And so Andy was working for XFM, and then the big company that owns Spin asked him to go to Jordan in the Middle East to set up a pop music station. And while he was there, they're like, before you go back to London, there's this Dublin station called Spin and it needs a bit of manners put on it. Will you swing over and do some time there? And so Andy came over for a little while. That's how we met. And he just said, hey, kid, I like what you're doing. I'm bringing you back to London with me to XFM. And it was like being, I suppose, playing for St. Pat's or whatever, and Alex Ferguson coming along and going, hey, you, I saw you play that game, you're coming to Man United. Like, it was that level of a jump. Like, it was, not that it was too big, but it was
big.
It was that break that you don't catch often.
Mm.
And it was pure good luck. And so he brought me over. It all happened kind of quickly in a few months, and I moved to London and I got a place to stay. And it was all a very exciting time. Or it should have been an exciting time, but I'd broken up with my girlfriend, Aoife, and we got out for about 4 years and didn't take it very well.
Do you remember the day you came in to see me in Spin?
I do. Yeah.
You were broken.
Yeah. Like, I can't remember. I can't remember why I actually, because we always talked. But we're not best friends.
Mm.
But I did text you one day going, hey, you're around. You might remember that better than me.
I felt like you knew where I was and you knew that I was in work.
Yeah.
And you knew that no one else was really around on Saturdays in Spain. And we could go down to an office.
Yeah.
You know, on the third floor where no staff were in. And you literally were broken. Like, I didn't know what to do, but I suppose that made us closer.
Yeah,
it's very hard to see your friend like that.
Yeah, thanks for that.
And you feel helpless, but I suppose what I got from it is that it was amazing that you rang someone.
Yeah, so I at that stage I think, so myself and you were there for a while. She ended up getting a medical placement in Glasgow. So she moved over there. You know, we were young enough. She was in a new country. We tried for a little while. It didn't work. She called it. Like, it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, I don't know. I was hoping we'd cling on for a little longer or whatever. And so I was devastated. But also, it was kind of weird because everything else in my life was kind of great. Like, all my family were happy and healthy. I had this awesome job. You know, no material problems. Had money in the bank, all that stuff. And so I kind of felt a bit stupid that I felt so devastated, or that it was kind of controlling all aspects of my life or whatever. And I couldn't really reconcile that.
And do you feel like, because it's similar thing happened to someone I know, they broke up with their girlfriend, you know, a young relationship. And I suppose when you're young, people go, sure, what's wrong with you? You'll be grand. You have everything else. Everything else is perfect. You'll get over it.
Yeah. And do you know what as well? Like, I almost think because everything in my life was kind of rosy, maybe that made it worse. I kind of feel like I never really faced any emotional test.
Mm.
And I kind of sauntered along with an easy ride. And then when I hit it, I just had no way to process it. And I guess just, you know, frustration or energy or whatever needs somewhere to go, needs a release. Oh, people love running, or I did exercise because they need to release some energy. And it just kind of built up and up and up and up and up, and it was nowhere for it to go. And then it, like, impulse one day just was kind of about to explode in my head, and yeah, just kind of picked up, I think it was just like a bathroom scissors or something like that, and kind of just started, you know, just scraping my arm or whatever. It's, Yeah, so that was not a pleasant time. But I think that happened once or twice before I went to London. And then it actually went away for a little while. And then the buzz of, oh, I'm moving to London, this is so exciting. And I went over. And it was strange because took over the show. And it takes about a year, I feel, really. Like, if on this show, hopefully Breakfast, it'll be quicker because half the audience would know who you are. But when you're coming in brand new, it takes a while for people to get to know you, to lose the listeners who were loyal to the last person, blah, 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 blah. So I went in, and actually for the first three listenership books, when the numbers come out every 3 months and they print them in all the papers, whatever, we dropped. So dropped a big one the first time, dropped a pretty medium one the second time, dropped an even bigger one the third time. And then all of a sudden, Andy, who was the guy, our former boss, who brought me over, he was like my friend over there. And then after the third book, it kind of switched. He went from being my friend to being my boss, as in, I've fired this guy who's really successful. You're the guy I've brought in. And I was a little bit distracted. He definitely had faith in ability or whatever, but I was a bit distracted because the Ethan thing had started. The novelty of being in London had worn off. Mm-hmm. The pressure was kind of really starting to sit. And he was like my big ally. And then all of a sudden he was in a tricky position with his bosses because, you know, what's going on here?
What's with this Irish guy?
Yeah. And so then it got pretty bad, the self-harm stuff, for not a long time, but like an intense short period of time.
Did you have anyone to turn to in London?
This sounds so showbiz. I did an interview with the script and Glenn is the drummer in the script. And we did this interview and he lived in London. And he was kind of a little bit lonely in London. And we ended up just going out for a pint one time. And he is this hyper-emotionally intelligent, perceptive, well-read guy. And I don't know what it was about him, but I just kind of told him. Don't know why, because I had other close friends, but it was that, it's maybe a little bit easier to confess to a priest or to a stranger or talk to a counsellor if you need therapy rather than a friend, because I knew him, but I didn't know him that well.
Yeah.
And we just ended up out, and he was amazing, and he just started bombarding me with all this literature. Read this, listen to this, do this, try this, here's cognitive behavioural therapy, here's what it's all about. Hey, do you want to go out for some lunch? You know, and so I had loads of other friends and I was socially busy, but I guess because we kind of got to know each other talking about that, I felt comfortable talking about it with him a lot.
At this point, did you feel like it was getting easier as soon as you opened up?
Oh, literally, like day one. That's why when I talk now, because I do a few talks with Theta every year and some, you know, teachers will ask me to go to schools and that kind of thing. Like that's what, you know, that whole, it's okay not to be okay message.
Yeah.
Like I kind of feel like that message has been around now for a good few years and I can see some frustration almost in, you know, in the mental health circuit, if you like, with that message going, right, yeah, we've established that message, can we move on and get, you know, get into the nitty gritty of emotional intelligence and all this kind of stuff. And I go, yes, I agree, but also don't underestimate the power of that message, because like having lived that for a little while, I go, for a good few months, it seemed like a better option to me to like self-harm than to tell somebody about it. Like, you know what I mean? Mm. So the fear of telling somebody seemed like a bigger deal than to carry on self-harming. So I kind of go, don't underestimate how terrifying that leap of telling somebody the first time is. Like, the worry that you'll be judged, or, you know, they think you're bats, or they want to know how to react, or all these things. But yeah, as soon as I started talking about it, it kind of went away. Like, as simple as that. Like, it wasn't this big, long, drawn-out thing. Once I started to read stuff and understand negative emotions and processing stuff and, you know, all these things, just gone.
And that's why I think if someone is going through a tough time, almost giving them a book or something is so much more powerful than sending a bunch of flowers. So like Clara Solin, who you know as well, she gave me Oprah's book and that changed my relationship with cancer. But, you know, to get things like that, that you can read or you can understand and then you can, you know, figure out why you're feeling the way you are.
Yeah.
Is so powerful.
Yeah. And it's true. Like there's wisdom in the simplicity of it, you know.
And then so did London life start to get a little bit better then?
Yeah, like it was this weird, it was almost like this dual life. So very quickly, and don't get me wrong, the radio show wasn't a disaster, but
I think the Guardian once said it was the best drive time show in the UK.
Yeah, that was I think in year two. So that's when it flipped, and then once we got that first year out of the way and also was in a much better space. And then it just turned around and we were pulling in listeners. And I think in like half a year in two books, we made up all the listeners we lost and then some. And then The Guardian wrote that really nice article.
What was it like when you read that?
It was very cool because we had turned a corner and all of a sudden acts were coming to us and we were getting a bit of a reputation and I was being asked to MC things around London. And then it all coincided with, and we got slagged for it loads in the papers, and I understand why. And also at the time we were all just a gang of normal people trying to make our way, some, you know, in more extraordinary ways than others. But Laura Whitmore was over and she was doing her MTV thing and she was really flying. And Brezzy had moved over the Blizzards. He'd wanted to bring the Blizzards to London, but a lot of the guys are family guys and they had jobs and it just wasn't feasible. So he went over to try be a songwriter. So he was there. Niall Horan had just done X Factor and One Direction were exploding like nobody's business.
But you could see why you guys all connected, because it was like family or like home. You were all normal people.
Plonked in this mad city, and like London's a great city, but it's a brutal city. Like there's a lot of people who are, I think there's like this veneer of civility. I think you've scratched under the surface in London very quickly, like you're only one shoulder bump away from someone ripping your fucking head off. Like there's a lot of people who are getting their ass kicked by London. Like it's a very expensive city. It can be quite an aggressive city. Like I lived in New York for a year after I finished up in UCD. I went over to a performing arts college there. And New York, I actually found it was like an easy city to be broken because there was just so much stuff going on. And I don't know why. I found, whereas London, not an easy city to be poor in. And it's that real thing of, what can you do for me? Nothing, right? Fuck you.
A lot of people listen to this podcast from London. And it's funny, a lot of them say, I feel like I'm home listening to your podcast. And London's only, 55 minutes away? You wouldn't think that you would feel so far away in London. But obviously, that is the vibe there.
It just feels like if you're not doing well, London will let you know.
Right.
Brez, I don't think he'll mind me saying, he didn't find it easy. And he didn't like it. Niall was having the absolute time of his life. And Brezzy was like a big brother to Niall Horan. Mm-hmm. Their dads know each other from Mullingar. And so Niall Horan's life was kind of gifting all of us these mad opportunities. Like just to go to stuff. He's like, lads, you want to come to this show or that premiere or this party, or you know, you're just meeting people you had no right to meet in these, it was the height of One Direction mania, and he kind of took us all along for the ride. So it was a really exciting time, and we got like the shit slagged out of us in the papers. Like
the thing about Niall, because I was an entertainment reporter at the height of his success, so I'd follow them a lot, Niall always came across like really normal.
He is, and that's the...
But, like, it's so hard to understand how, like, you're put in this biggest boy band in the whole world. Like, you got people doing everything for you, and he was able to remain normal. Like, how do you think he could do that?
I guess it's just a disposition. Like, you know, I don't think it's any secret. Not all of the boys took it that well. So I guess it's just a pre-wiring or a disposition or good people around him. Like Niall lives with his cousin, who's a little bit older. He's in, you know, he's in finance over there. So I think he really looked after him in a business sense. He had a lot of Irish friends around him.
And did you feel protective of him, or did you kind of feel like he was grand?
At the start, because he was 17, 18. Mm. Like now he's a man. And it's very funny actually watching that shift, watching him go from a teenager to, in the space of 2 years, he had traveled to countries that you'll probably never travel to. Mm. Like he could tell you what it's like in every country in the, you know, in the world practically that's not in a state of war he'd been to. He had met people you'll never meet, meeting presidents and luminaries and sports stars, and you know, and he's very personable and he's confident. So it's actually at the very start, I think we all felt a bit protective of him, but then it became very apparent he could handle himself easily. So, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of melted away.
So your time in London came to an end in what year?
I went over 2012. No, that's wrong. I went over the start of 2011 and I was there for 4 years.
Why did you come home?
I've not told this story properly. So I was doing XFM and I got offered a job on Capital, which is like the, it's apart from BBC Radio 1, it's the big commercial music station. It's part of the XFM, the parent company owned both stations in the same building. It's on the same floor. And I got offered their weekend breakfast show. And like this, it's terrible. It is what it is. But one time, so everybody in XFM and Capital would send, you do your invoice for your month and you'd send it to this one lady in accounts. She would make sure all the figures are correct, approve your invoice and send it to accounts and you get paid. And one day, she approved everybody's accounts, and instead of sending on the accounts, the invoices to accounts for payment, she sent on everybody's invoice to everybody in the building.
No.
CC'd all. Like, like there were people running through the halls going, delete that email! Delete that email!
Oh my God.
Physically going up to every single desk, and I want to physically see you delete that email. Because huge implications, because agents negotiate contracts, it's confidential, and people will play numbers. Oh, well, I think so-and-so is getting paid that. I want parity, or the station would lie. We're only paying that person that much. You're not getting any more. But actually, that person's getting way more. There's a lot of confidential stuff, and there was big repercussions for everybody knowing what everyone else is getting paid. But they had sent it to my work email, but they also had my personal email on the mailing list from when I just arrived before I got my staff email. So I deleted it right there in front of them. But then I went home and it was sitting there in my personal email. So
was there a part of you that was going to delete it though?
No way. I handed in my notice to XFM, and our boss, former boss Andy, who brought me over, he had actually left about half a year previous. He decided to go into a family tech business. So there was a new boss in. I handed in my notice. And ridiculously, I didn't have an agent at the time. So I handed in my notice. He's like, right, fine. Contract's not getting renewed. Good luck. And we didn't have a massive connection. He was a new boss. I was on the way out, whatever. And the boss of Capital got fired about 2 weeks later. And so I had kind of handed in my notice to XFM. My boss, who brought me over and hired me, was proud of me and all that, he was gone. I was maybe 30 at that stage. And I had kind of maybe a little smidge of ego at that stage. I'd kind of gone, I'm off to the big station. And he got fired. I hadn't signed a contract. And then the new boss of Capital came in, and he hired Marvin from JLS, and he wanted names. Mm. And he wasn't feeling what I was doing, and certainly didn't like the accent, I don't think. And so I met with the overlord boss, and he was like, look, you've done amazing on X. Things are absolutely flying. And like our last book, we added like 70,000 listeners in a book, or 67. Like it was, we were in a good space. So he was like, look, you're really well regarded in the group. I can't go over this guy, the new boss's head. So just sit tight for a while. We'll figure something out. Yada, yada, yada. And then I got called for a pilot for Radio 1, which is even bigger than Capital, I suppose. It's probably the biggest station in the world. And so I went in and I did the pilot. I got an agent after the whole capital debacle. I was like, shit, I need an agent. So the only thing I was doing at that stage was I was doing this online show for Sony with them. You know, Catherine Ryan, she's a comedian. Mm-hmm. She's on like 8 out of 10 Cats and stuff.
Yes.
So we were doing this show together. But got an agent, got into Radio 1, and we did a pilot. And they came back and they said, okay, we like it. Here's some notes. Go work on these notes and come back again. Went back a second time. Okay, we like it. Refine some more. Come back again. So we got to pilot number 4. And my agent was going, look, I've had people in Radio 1 loads. And no one's ever gotten past pilot 1. Like, you're at the races here. And then a really bizarre, went in for pilot number 4. And it felt very serious then. And there was a slot coming up. There was also a weekend show. And I kind of said, oh, this is like now or never. And they said, okay, we want you to pilot for this specific show with this producer. See you then. So went in, and that's, you're kind of going, right, this is your shot, like. And I don't know what it was, but I went in, and the producer, he didn't want to be there. It felt like an imposition immediately. He didn't know that I even had worked for XFM. I don't think he quite understood even how many pilots had come before. He just seemed a bit pissed off with everything. And then I found out afterwards, and I was kind of saying, oh, I'm going to do this. And he's like, no, just talk. Just talk, and that's all. You don't need to do any fancy stuff. And I was like, well, I know, like, I got some feedback from the other one. And he's like, no, trust me. Just, you know, and we really hit it off on a bad note. And then I found out afterwards that he had reported to the bosses that I had been late for the pilot. And then it kind of got to this stage. It was really sour grapes when we had parted company anyway. And then I had to, like, you know, my agent had to pull the time records from BBC to show that I had signed in like 15 minutes early, that I'd been waiting. Like, it got really murky, and then it went quiet. And maybe I wouldn't have got the show anyway. That's not to say, mm-hmm. because I had a fight with the producer, I didn't get a job on Radio 1. But that's when it stopped.
That's hard.
Yeah, it was. It was hard. And then at that point, Louise McSharry got sick. She had cancer, and she made a full recovery, thank God, also. But she was away for 6 months, and I'd been doing The Voice. I'd been nipping back and forward from London doing The Voice. So I was kind of on RT's radar at that stage. And they said, look, do you want to cover this evening show? And so did that. And that kind of went well, and we were having a lot of fun. And then they said, do you want to do the weekend breakfast show? And that went well. And then they said, look, we want you to come full time and do the drive show that I've been doing the last 4 years. So it kind of was a random happenstance.
Mm.
It was kind of fell back home rather than consciously decided to move back home. I was happy to do it, but kind of said, oh, I'll come and do this for a little while, and then I'll go back to the UK. And then, you know,
yeah.
you buy a house and you get a bit older.
And tell us about something else you've also been really honest about. And I was shocked when I heard about it, the attack in 2016.
I was out Stevens's Day 2016, just over in Clondalkin with my cousin, who's one of my best pals, and his gang, and just had a few drinks and left a little bit early, was a bit just tired or whatever. And it's the Laurels in Clondalkin, go there a lot, it's a lovely place. Clondalkin, I think, has a disproportionately bad rep. That, like, certainly the village is gorgeous. It's got like an old school round tower, and it's a beautiful little village, and never had any trouble there. And just went around the corner to like go get some dodgy Chinese and get a cab, and was on the phone to Aoife, who at this stage I was back with, and don't remember anything after that. Just woke up in Tala Hospital, and my cousin was there, and Aoife was there, and had been. I've now since seen the like CCTV. So I was just standing there on the phone, and these two lads just kind of come around the corner across the road, and one guy just big massive swing and just cracks me in the back of the head, and I fell down. This other guy just comes in and like follows it with a big kick, and that was it. I was kind of knocked out, and so I was on the phone to Aoife, so she kind of heard it all, and you know, kind of got a vague idea of what was going on. So she rang my cousin who was in the pub and he ran out and they kind of just, you know, bundled me in the cab and got me to hospital or whatever. So it was, I don't remember it. So it's not like I've been back to the Laurels loads and it's not like it's, I have, there's no, like I'm not, it's not traumatic in that sense. But,
did you feel like you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so it's weird. I still haven't fully reconciled it. I haven't really figured it out. Like I lost, I've lost my sense of taste and smell.
Still to this day.
It's not coming back yet. It's gone. That's a pain in the ass. But like, it's like an inconvenience now is what I'd call it, rather than something that gets me really worked up. Like I miss tastes and smells and like stuff like Aoife has a smell. Mm-hmm. Like she'd, you know, like a, she wears like a perfume or.
And you, nothing.
No, like I could tell you if something is salty or bitter or sweet, but I couldn't, like, you know, if you put salt on strawberries, I'd eat them and I'd know there was something salty on the sweet thing, but I couldn't tell you it was strawberries. If I ate a chocolate bar, I couldn't tell you if it was mint or coffee. That's a good example.
And then you went on to make that show, and then the girl who came up to you, her name was
Sasha. Yes.
Was it like to meet her?
So did a documentary for T.G. Carr about random acts of violence, and that was a chance happening. My friend said, I was talking to this girl who found you when you fell. So when I fell, she was in the Chinese and she came out and she picked up the phone and I think explained to Aoife what had happened. Then Aoife, you know, called my cousins, etc. And so apparently I had, like, you know, blood all in my mouth. So she turned my head over because it was all gargling blood and all that crack. And apparently I started, like, swearing at her. And, like, maybe I thought she was the person who was... I don't remember any of that, but that's what she told me. So that was strange. Apparently there was loads of people, not loads of people, but there was people around, but she was the first person to come up and intervene and, you know.
But do you think that it's added another kind of layer of empathy in your personality in terms of it probably allows you to connect with people in a different way? It's like the cancer to me has just made me think about things differently.
Yeah.
Has your life experiences... It all leads you to where you are now.
Yeah, I've definitely probably gotten a little bit softer. Yeah, more empathy maybe is the thing. But all, like, I didn't, that's what I'm saying, I don't remember it and I have no, like, post-traumatic stress thingy. But also, like, my personality definitely changed for a good while. And I wouldn't say it's 100% back to where it was. Like, I definitely became more introverted. And even in conversations with people I was very comfortable with, like my own friends, kind of stopped talking. And I had to, it was a friend who said it to me first. And I was glad they said it because I kind of thought in my head, I was like, this is happening. I'm not imagining this. And he just one day said to me, he was like, are you okay? You know, you've been very quiet like the last few months. Is something going on? I think he maybe thought, you know... is there relationship problems or whatever? And I was like, I'm glad you said that. Yeah, I don't feel myself. I don't feel bad. I don't feel like panicky, but I just don't feel. I was just kind of sitting in silence a lot.
Is it like you were kind of on the outside looking in or something?
Yeah, a little bit floating above myself or whatever. And so then he said it. I started to say it to other friends of mine, and they all kind of went, yeah. Absolutely, yeah, you've been kind of vacant. And even that kind of tied in a bit with the show, the radio show, being this big fun show to being a bit more of a straight, let's talk about current affairs-y pop culture show. Maybe that suited my personality a bit more. I don't know, like I still haven't fully figured out that. Like it was also because the production team changed or whatever, but definitely I think that maybe had something to do with it, I don't know.
So do you think then it's so important if you notice that your friend maybe is just acting, there's just something like off to flag it?
Yeah. Like, no, I don't think anyone, even if you get it wrong, no one will ever think you're a bad friend for checking in on them. That's never an outcome that will realize itself. Like you might get someone going, don't be daft. Or even if they laugh at you because you've read the situation wrong. that's a perfectly acceptable result for inquiring after someone's well-being. Yeah.
This podcast is all about self-care, and you know, I'm all into the self-care for women and to check ourselves. But I want to hear it from a guy's point of view. Like, do you practice self-care? Do you make time for yourself?
Getting better at it.
And why is that? Is that just because you've become more aware of it?
Yeah. Yeah, like the all the like the self-harmy stuff was good in terms of learning emotional resilience and like isolating negative thoughts and removing them and trying to counteract them. And then this, the last while with the whole like personality shift, just like I find running is an incredible release. Like the world is a little bit better after a run. Like when you get that burning thing in your lungs, it's pretty like that whole thing of, you should exercise. It's good for your mental health. Such a cliche at this stage, but it's a cliche, I guess, because it's true.
Is there anything else that you do?
I've stepped away from social media a good bit. Not so Instagram, I kind of enjoy as a spectator. I'm not good at it. Like Dieran, she's so good at social media. Whereas I find it really laboursome, you know, doing a, hey guys, just doing this thing. Even if it's the thing we're talking about, I don't enjoy that side of it. But like, I used to love Twitter and I used to love a bit of argy bargy, pick of fights with people. And mm-hmm. Now I find it so heavy, and it's a real dog-eat-dog world. And the people, like the anonymity that the internet affords people, it really emboldens them to be the worst versions of themselves. And particularly when you're a public-facing job, you're kind of fair game, and no one's coming for you. No one's coming to step in for you. So people will say things that they've no right to say, or that they don't even mean. Like, I've had people say the nastiest shit you can imagine. But even stuff like, I hate you, you're shit, you make me sick, I want to scratch my... Like, and that's... I say, I'm talking about my own experience, but I've seen that again, like, about people who are so harmless mm-hmm. and so benign. Like, people just say the nastiest stuff. And even all this, like, this Love Island stuff recently... like I work on the Australian Love Island, but I'm not, I did it one time, I'm the narrator, if people didn't know that. But I'm not so beholden to it that I wouldn't criticise it if I didn't feel it was warranted. Like this whole thing about the duty of care around contestants, I thought the big thing that was so glaringly absent from that conversation after the Jeremy Kyle thing that really pissed me off was people were going for the producers, and they were legitimate target of concern, and you need to up your game, and I think they have. But the absence of like collective responsibility of,
yes,
it's not like reality television has. I think Big Brother, for example, is probably a more dangerous show. Like Big Brother, as Jeremy Kyle, relies on people being in compromising situations. Like I think at the heart of it, like Love Island, like season 3 was the one that exploded it in the UK, if people remember, like the Chris and Kem bromance and Camilla being a bit of a fish out of water. It's actually like, it was quite a sweet, it was mm-hmm. the sweeter storylines that made it this big success. But the absence of any collective responsibility of, it's the public who say these awful things about people who are absolutely harmless, and there's no collective responsibility, like the toll that takes on people. That was a very long-winded way of saying Twitter is a horrible place.
And would you go looking for comments? Like, you know, at the launch of this new show, are you going to be looking to see what people are saying?
I was very aware. Like, I'm aware of what people are saying, good or bad. Like, that's to say, when we started this 2FM show and it was The Zoo and it was that the producer Reg I mentioned, and it was that, like, we had people, and our, you know, our numbers were going through the roof. So you kind of go, that's the proof right there. But people texting in going, I love this show, I had to pull in my car, I was laughing so much. Versus, oh, fuck's sake, Breakfast. Oh, Jesus, is he going to be talking about global warming and gender politics and all this stuff? So I see that. And no is the answer. Like, it's a fun show and I'm like, you know, I'm good at fun radio. So I'm enjoying the challenge of flipping, like changing the minds of people. So that bit's fine, but it's the, yeah, it's the gauntlet of internet commentary. I won't look for it, but I know it's there.
But you also experienced, like, when you did Love Island Australia, like, the tweets that came in, the positive stuff.
Yeah.
About how brilliant you were on it. Like, that must have been great.
Yeah, that was a hit. It was. And I guess it's that thing of, it's not currency in Ireland because we're all Irish, but in Australia, like, your accent, my accent to them is as exotic as and as kind of mental as Ian's is on the UK one. And so you have such license with that, and you can take the piss a bit more, and you could just be bold, and it just hit the right note. And same again, like, we got, it's not nice, but I don't believe, if you like, if you look at a comment and you go, oh, my God, it's the worst thing to happen to radio ever. I don't believe that. And then I also don't believe, you know, the people that go, this guy is, he's the fucking greatest thing that's ever happened to a TV show. Neither of those things are true. Mm. But it's just how much stock you choose to place in one. People will always place more stock in negative stuff that's said about them. It's human nature. So it's more dangerous.
You seem to be in a really good place now. You've got a great base with Aoife. She clearly makes you very happy.
She's wonderful and very patient. She was amazing around the post, like the post concussion time, because that hit us hard enough. Because I was a little bit, I was kind of, I knew something was up with myself, but I didn't quite know what. I hadn't had that conversation with my friends of, you're a bit out, you know, you're a bit introverted or whatever. And so I was struggling with that a little bit, and maybe it manifested itself in being a bit narky with her, just frustrated, like, and then I wasn't really connecting with her the way we had always connected, and we weren't laughing as much, and I didn't have a great explanation as to why, and, but, you know, it was kind of almost avoiding coming home some evenings, or maybe going out to a few more gigs, and just kind of getting myself into a space I didn't want to be in. It's like, stopped drinking the last year, not exclusively, I like have a pint, but I haven't been drunk, I'd say, in like a year and 14 months, save for my birthday last year when I got rode off and realised why I didn't drink. So
we're all allowed a blip.
Yeah, we're allowed a blip. So that's been good. It's been good for the head. So she's been amazing, was the point of that. Yeah, she's been very patient.
Well, it's amazing to see you in such a good space. You're such a good friend of mine. Thank you for doing the good glow.
Do we want to finish on like a high or a joke or something? I feel like that was all very heavy.
Listen, the good glow is about real feeling zone.
Okay.
Please tell us a joke, though, if you would like to finish this episode on a high. Well, we did finish it on a high with your wonderful girlfriend.
Done. Yeah, she is wonderful. She can have the last one. She's awesome.
Thanks.
Thanks, George.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, made possible by Sally Hansen. To discover more, you can shop the products in Macaulay Health and Beauty Pharmacies and other stores across the country now. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe so you can be the first to hear about new ones. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. To all my listeners in Ireland and those of you around the world, thank you for the amazing support and continued feedback. You can find out more about my story on thegoodglow.ie and follow me on Instagram at georgie.crawford.